Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kiley.
I'm Josh Ute.
And I'm Heather Johnson.
And this is Engaging Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. On today's episode, we're going to talk about how we can do more to create better shared experiences in an individualized world. And we welcome Christian Downs, National Training Director from Alpha USA, to the program to talk to us about how we can have better, more natural faith conversations with seekers and non-believers. All of that and more on this episode of Engaging Culture. Well, hi, everyone. Welcome to the Engaging Culture Podcast. Brian Kiley here with you. And we have a guest host for today's episode, the one and only Heather Johnson.
Woo! Hey.
Here you are. Thrilled to be here, I'm sure.
So excited.
We are thrilled to have you. But I must know, Pastor Heather, what is the best thing you saw this week?
Oh, well, I would even say it was experienced this week,
wow.
Not just saw.
Okay.
We went out for dinner for my husband's birthday, and it just felt a little bit more like a special occasion. We've been through a little bit of a personal challenging season for the last year, and it felt like it was time to celebrate. And so we are best friends of 30 plus years, and our son and his fiance and Dave and I spent a silly amount of money on a really, really nice dinner. And I was still reflecting on it, honestly, the morning after, just the tastiness of the food, but really the richness of the relationships, how long we've been friends and how easy it was to be around the table, and how special that my kids are sharing in this with my best friends of so many years, and just celebrating my husband. And it was really, really beautiful evening.
And especially, I mean, you guys have just walked through a lot these last couple of months, of course, and to have that time of celebration. Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. On a Monday night?
On a Monday night, no less. Oh, that's fantastic.
I do have to say, Heather, I think you might have missed your calling as a soft rock DJ with your you have such like a gentle, like engaging, it's like, hey, this is like toned your voice. Brian's kind of, you know, abrasive. I sound a bit like a stoner. It's a nice change. It's so nice. It's like, I can listen to this all day. This is so pleasant.
Well, we'll just bring some relaxation.
There it is.
Heather Johnson on Y92.5.
Yeah.
Oh. All right. Hey, I got a new job, Brian.
What is the best thing you saw this week?
The best thing I saw this weekend, not only did the Seahawks win the Super Bowl in the most boring Super Bowl of all time, but there was a commercial near the end of the game by He Gets Us that was actually way better than their normal commercial sets that they do. So the He Gets His campaign is a Christian organization that's trying to spur up conversations about Jesus through different ad campaigns. And typically they are Jesus is like you type of campaign. But this one was all about the desire for in our society to have more. And so while we could play you the commercial, the audio is not that engaging, and it's all about the visuals. So that's not great on a podcast. However, what it did was it actually sparked a really interesting idea in my mind as somebody who's like, okay, the world is saying more. And then it ends with this tagline is, what if there's more than just more? And what if Jesus could show you the way?
Wow.
And I thought that was such a powerful way of engaging our conversations, because I've had conversations with folks, especially on my hockey team, who are above the age of 45, where you can tell they're kind of disillusioned with the aspects of different parts of life. Like this isn't quite what I thought it was going to be. And you see this with professional athletes. You see this with highly successful people, that they get to the mountaintop and they assume like getting the gold medal was worth it all. And 10 years later, they're selling their gold medals and they're selling this off and that off.
Right.
Like it didn't fulfill them.
Yeah.
And I thought that is such a great conversation of like, how does Jesus fulfill us versus how the world says we're going to be fulfilled?
Yeah.
It was really powerful.
Yeah. And you and I were texting obviously a bit during the game, and both of us kind of had that same response of like, wow, that was a really great ad. And I've been skeptical of some things that I've seen from He Gets Us in the past. that really I thought spoke to that level of disillusionment that I think we see all around us. Yeah. And it was beautifully done.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So my best thing was bittersweet, of course. I'm just really appreciative of all the different ways we were able to kind of send off our beloved Pastor Judah these last several days. Obviously, getting to pray with him in services was the most public element. You know, he and I have had a number of one-on-one conversations processing his departure, which have been very special. As a staff, on Tuesday morning, we were able to celebrate him, which the two of you were a part of that, of course, and that was a lot of fun. And then, you know, we had twice a month our Next Gen team meets together in my office, and we kind of had our regular meeting, and it wasn't like we had anything specific, like planned per se, like, all right, everybody say something about Judah at the end. He goes last in our meeting anyway, in terms of sharing updates from his ministry, and just said some really beautiful words of appreciation about our team, which was neat. And then all of us got to just express that back to him. And it was very emotional. It's now the third time I have I have shed tears in something related to Pastor Judah's departure. But it was a very, very special time. And, you know, you just look at somebody who has given so much to this organization and has meant so much to all of us personally that I'm just really pleased with. I feel like he's done a great job with navigating the transition, and I feel like we have given him sort of the send-off that a person like him is worthy of. So I feel sad still, but very happy at all of that. It's very special.
So. Ending well is a gift.
Yep, sure is. All right, well, we are not ending well now. We're going to be right back with another segment, so stay tuned.
For this next segment, we're going to talk a little bit about the loss of shared experiences in an individualized world. So there's a tension that we have to manage in our lives where it's easiest. There's a tension that we need to manage in our lives where we are simultaneously at the best time to have personalized entertainment, personalized actions. We can schedule our lives around the things that we already want to do versus trying to manipulate other things in order to match what's going on. But we've also lost a lot of something. Right now, we have more fake connection digitally where we can see each other on Facebook or Instagram and we feel like we're having this connection, but we have less meaningful connection in person. And then we are less formed spiritually because of this isolation. And so we've just lost a lot of these shared experiences. And so today I wanted to take some time to explore a little bit of how we ended up here, but also what can we be doing instead that's going to be spiritually beneficial, community beneficial, and ultimately more fulfilling in our own lives. So, Pastor Brian, what are some examples of shared experiences that used to be normal?
I mean, there are so many. I think one really simple one is even entertainment and television. If you look at what are the top-rated TV shows of today, none of them would even crack the top 25 30 years ago in terms of number of viewers, right? We are so diverse in even our entertainment habits that it's almost like we've all had the experience of like, it's like fun to find someone else who watches the same show as you. Whereas like,
discovering
nobody would be
treasure.
Like, no one would be like, wow, you watch Seinfeld too? Like everyone watched Seinfeld back in the day, right? So that sense of we experience this together and therefore, we're all able to talk about it. You could say same thing about other forms of entertainment. I still think we have some shared experiences around movies, but even then, not as much, or sporting events or things like that. And then beyond that, I mean, you alluded to this a moment ago, Josh, so much of our quote unquote communication with others and the way we experience the world is mediated through technology, which is shaping our reality in different ways. And I don't necessarily mean that negatively, though there are some negative consequences to it, that we're not having, say, shared experiences out in the like real world together, but rather we're having kind of these customized experiences through algorithms and the things that we search for and our interests that are causing us to experience the world in just radically different ways.
Yeah. I mean, I even think about how I communicate. You know, like before, we used to have to pick up a phone and and call somebody and they would answer or not answer. And then we would have a real conversation.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Now, I mean, sometimes somebody texts me at 8 a.m. and I actually don't respond until 8 p.m.
Yeah.
Because that's what's more convenient for me. And so my life isn't interrupted. And some of it comes from a good place because I want to be thoughtful in my response. But it's also very individualized.
Right. It's funny to me. I've got a couple of people in my life who don't really text, but will just call. And it's weird to me how weird that feels.
Yeah.
Like just calling unannounced. Like, what are we doing here? I'm like, it's a phone call. Like, it's not I
know. Yeah.
Then you watch like, an old TV show and people would just show up at each other's houses unannounced.
Yeah.
And you kind of forget like, that's so normal, and yet now it's really not.
Yeah, I think about the family dynamics, too, of the fact that we make it a point that we sit down and eat dinner together 9 out of 10 times. 90% of the time, we're eating dinner together, no matter what that is. We try to figure that out. Yeah. We prioritize dinners together. But I've talked to a lot of people where the only dinner they have together is once a week, maybe on a Sunday.
Wow.
Everybody else has their own schedules and it's just like, it's all out of come and go. It's food's ready whenever you're ready type of a thing. And I thought, man, that is such a different vibe. Because when I was growing up, everybody had a dinner time. The street lights came on. Uh-huh. You ran home to your own homes, had dinner with your family. Like that was a very normal part of growing up. And I think we miss a lot of family connection because we don't have that shared time together. Why do you think convenience has made us more isolated?
Convenience, almost by definition, eliminates our need for other people.
Yeah. Mm.
So much of, I think, the more frequent interdependence of past generations was truly a matter of necessity. Whether it's Amazon or big box stores or just our general prosperity as a society relative to past times. Like we just don't need things from people anymore.
Yeah.
Acquiring new items is easy. So I don't need to borrow from my neighbors. Entertaining myself on my own, I have limitless options and a phone and a Netflix account is more interesting than another human being and requires less of me, right? Which like that sounds like really rough to say, but like it is objectively true. Now, that doesn't mean it's good for us.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
So that idea of going, there is now this inertia I have to overcome to go, I'm going to step away from what is most convenient to me in the moment and that requires no vulnerability.
Yeah.
Now I need to do something that feels vulnerable, that might be a little bit awkward, that might be a little bit boring relative to just watching whatever I want to watch, to now engage with a person. And there's less natural overlap, right? Like the common spaces where we just bump into each other have really decreased.
Yeah. I mean, I think convenience by its very nature is self-focused.
Mm. Yeah. That's a great point.
Yeah, that's a great point. Now, there are some really good things that have happened within the personalization, especially within spiritual development, which, you know, podcasts or Bible studies or books, you know, whatever that might be for you. And so there's a lot that is beneficial about the individual. But what is lost when we individualize our spiritual formation?
Like you said, there's a lot of benefit to that. But I am skeptical of if you carry it out to kind of the its logical end, sort of this buffet style spiritual formation where I can pursue content that appeals to my wants as opposed to maybe my needs, where I can be formed and shaped in ways that are disconnected from community, spiritual formation becomes very individualized instead of something that I do with others. And it sort of fits into kind of like our American independent ethos that, well, I just kind of do my own thing with the Lord. When I think the Apostle Paul would be like, what are you doing? That makes no sense. This is meant to happen in community. So I think that element can really get lost, and that's a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, we literally can't. Is this too obvious? I'm like, no. We can't practice the second greatest commandment, which is loving your neighbor as yourself. I mean, with that, you can't do that by yourself. You have to actually have a neighbor. As simple as that is,
that is completely foreign to so many people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's so interesting about it is that I have a lot of conversations with friends who might have left the church, but like, but me and the Lord are fine. I do my own thing. I don't need the church to do that. And I pity them in a lot of ways because, like, man, you're getting such watered down version of what biblical community could be.
Yeah.
And you and the Lord might have a great like one-on-one connection, but that's only one part of the great commandments. You know, if the, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart. Great. That's there. But now, and the second is like it. The second is like, and I think we miss that. Pastor Heather, if you don't mind me putting you on the spot a little bit, the early church in Acts has this shared life as spiritual formation. What did that look like? Why do you think that was so important for the early church?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was how their culture expressed their faith. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it was just natural. And they had that rhythm of, you know, worship in the synagogue and the home. So it was worship in the synagogue and life together in a home, some type of meal together, celebration, Sabbath. It would be a foreign concept for them to actually think about pursuing Jesus as an individual. Like it just, mm-hmm. I think we cannot translate this into our Western culture because it would be so foreign to them to even have that idea because they lived communally.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It was, they worshiped together, they ate together, they prayed together, they shared resources and all of that. And lest we get Pollyanna about like, oh, well, everything was perfect and they all just loved each other and kumbaya and wouldn't that be great? And man, that's impossible now with, you know, crazy people who have been radicalized by social media. Like, they had issues if you read the book of Acts. So it's not like it was all sunshine and puppy dogs, but there was this intensity of shared commitment. And here's the part that really challenges me with this is I go, oh, you know, it's easy to like, oh, well, they were just so committed to each other and all of that. They didn't have any other choice.
Yeah.
I'm not sure they'd do any better with smartphones and Netflix available to them than we do. But because they didn't have any other choice, and I'm not saying I want to go back to, you know, that age of technology or anything, but because they didn't have any other choice, they didn't really have a lot of things pulling them away from one another.
Right.
So I think that speaks to us and our need to go, okay, what does it look like to put these other options in their proper place, but still like foster that level of commitment to each other that will lead to our spiritual growth and our health?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder about that though, because every generation has said it's harder to raise kids than it's ever been. Like you've heard that over and over and over and over and over again. And maybe to some degree that might be right. I think it's just different. Their distractions were different than our distractions. So while we're distracted by technology, they're distracted by, you know, need of food. You know, like
really trying hard not to die.
Yeah. You know, like there's lots of distractions that could be. There's a lot of personal pursuit that still existed in that time because you see, pick up your cross daily. Like this is like that, that is dying to yourself. If you don't have any distractions in life, there's no, that doesn't make any sense. Like, oh yeah, this is just part of it. But I do think what's really interesting is that they were so, so consumed by that this is their identity, that their Christian community was their identity versus a thing that they believed. Yeah. And I think right now we're in a pivotal moment within Bridgeway, but also just kind of a global church or Western church rather, that we are really seeing that the need to be identified as a group is much higher than it's been in a long time. And I say that because we're seeing as new folks are coming in, they have this hunger to be a part of who Bridgeway is, like that I am a part of Bridgeway. Not, yes, they're a part of the faith, but like they really want this part. And we see that within the way that we talk about social issues and like this, say tribalism, and it triggers all sorts of different things in there. And I don't mean it in a negative way, but just like this is my tribe, this is my group, this is my family, this is our identity. And I wonder if we're in a moment right now where people are seeing the need for communal identity more than just individual identity.
That's a really interesting thought. And yeah, perhaps we are beginning to see the first stages of kind of a backlash against individualism because we've seen it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And the challenge there goes, are we going to form tribes or anti-tribes? Mm. And uh, there are there are a lot of forces in our world today pushing us into anti-tribes, where we are formed by what we're against, where it's a much more sort of defensive and hostile idea of like, hey, we're all united because we agree that they're the bad guys, which, don't get me wrong, there are a lot of bad guys in the world.
Right.
But the early church was not an anti-tribe, it was a tribe. I mean, certainly they stood against different things, but they were united by their faith in Christ and a positive vision of what life in the kingdom was meant to look like. So, you look at churches, and the hope would be that a church can be a tribe, where a tribe is defined by what it is for. A tribe is welcoming and inclusive because it's not defined by what it's against.
Yeah.
And it can lead people towards health. And that is interesting. And it's encouraging, to see, and I've seen that as well, different folks who are newer to the church sort of desiring that sense of group identity.
Yeah.
I imagine you've probably seen that a little bit too, Pastor Heather.
Yeah, well, and I think it's really easy to take pride in something that's healthy.
Mm.
I mean, right? I mean, I want to be a part of a healthy team, of a healthy community. And I both contribute to that, so I have some personal pride. And then I'm proud of the group, you know. So it's I don't feel like I'm articulating myself very well, but that is contagious.
Yeah.
To be a part of something like that builds its own momentum.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think we see that in healthy families across generations, you know, they've got their, you know, their J for Johnson, you know, their family slogan, you know, I mean, these things seem cheesy, but they're actually very meaningful.
Yeah. Well, and this even goes back to, you know, Josh, where you got us started with the idea of shared experience.
Yeah.
And part of what we're able to offer as a church community, and it's not unique to Bridgeway, other churches can as well, is that sense of shared experience. Were you at that service where they talked about this? Were you at that event where this took place? Did you have this experience? Did your kids have this experience?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think there is a, hopefully, growing hunger for that sort of thing.
Yeah. And I think we undervalue the casual shared experience. Mm. I think it's one of the things that we've really grown in the last couple of years is creating those hangout spaces, the fun newcomers dinners with games and, you know, kind of allowing our kind of actually encouraging, you know, some of our upfront pastoral staff to be silly and real, to kind of show their real selves in different environments and encouraging that from others. You know, kind of revamping our cafe and making that a hangout space, putting hangout time into our events.
Yeah.
You know, I just think that we can sometimes undervalue the kind of how important that is and how much time it takes to build enough trust and shared experience and small talk that can actually lead to those deeper shared experiences.
That's a really great point. Because I think it's really easy for us to say, this is frivolous. This doesn't really mean that much. It's just kind of fun.
And
that's fine, but it's not spiritually significant when in actuality, it's the first step to a lot of spiritual significance.
Yep.
Trust building is pivotal for everyone, and you build trust through shared experience. You build trust through through conversation, through testing of your trust, through taking risk. Like that, these are all trust building pieces that you can't do on your own. So just to kind of shift gears a little bit here is there's an invitation model to community that it's like, while we have easily identified the problems here, there is a framework in which we can actually combat this isolation in different ways. And so, and Jesus gives us a model throughout his ministry. And so the first stage that I would say would be come and see, where Jesus starts with invitation. There's no pressure. There's no expectation. It's just proximity. It's this idea that Jesus is going to preach to a very large group of people. He's not requiring anything from them. He doesn't have a, okay, you can come if you do this type of thing. It's not a quid pro quo type of relationship that he has with the masses. And it's just very much a come and see. So what made it safe in that time for it to be a come and see? And what makes it safe now?
I mean, this is Jesus from John chapter 1, where we're talking about some of his initial followers. And even the invitation, again, that they received to come and see. And if I had John 1 in front of me, I would get the names of everyone right. But this was an invitation given from one person to another. And I think that that speaks to a few things. Number one, I think that we have sort of a weird relationship with invitations as a society. I think as we've grown more individualized, just simply inviting people into casual spaces has decreased a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
So that has then increased maybe the suspicion we have around invitations, kind of a, oh, well, what's the catch? Or, oh, is it going to be weird? Or, oh, are they going to talk to me about politics or some other topic I don't wish to discuss? And so I think that there's a lot of value in being the sorts of people who can invite people into our spaces truly with no obligation or sort of mixed motive and just create spaces where easy conversation can be had. If we're talking about, you know, at a church, we're having events that are low barrier to entry, meant to be comfortable, meant to be very invitational. You talk about our homes, we're inviting people into our space, maybe serving food, and just we're having a good time. There's not a big, you know, there's no Tupperware sales pitch at the end, right? but I think, I don't know, I'm struggling to come up with real specifics, but I think just that mentality of going, I want to invite people into my space with the goal of them sort of feeling at home, I think that is a huge aspect of it. You're so great at hospitality, Pastor Heather. Talk to us a little bit about what makes for a great come and see environment.
Well, I think it's being genuinely interested in one another. I mean, honestly.
Yeah, I'm out.
I mean.
And pass. What else?
But it is, it's a. Yeah. It's a posture. It's a mindset. It's a this person. I'm curious about this person, and they're curious about me.
Yeah,
it's reciprocal. It's let's discover one another. Man, what did you do last Friday night? Here's what I did last Friday night. That's really different. Tell me more. Yeah. You know, it's a posture in which how we view people, not as commodities. What can they do for me? But as individuals. You know, that are beautifully fascinating and quirky and, you know, and we can decide, hey, we don't have anything in common. I'm not really going to pursue that. But I got to come in curious and expectant.
That curiosity concept, I just think is a game changer in interpersonal relationships.
Yep.
It's huge. Yeah.
So the next stage is to know others and be known by others. So it's moving from attending to recognizing faces to being known. And to being known, I don't mean just that somebody knows your name, but that they actually know a bit about who you are and that you know a bit about who they are. What makes someone feel known?
Tidbits of information. I mean, I've got to know something about your life.
Right.
Enough that I can ask a follow-up question.
I think that's right. I think that sort of basic exchange of information is really important. And, you know, you ask the question, what makes someone feel known? That sure, there is, on some level, I feel known by people who have some awareness of my life or maybe some awareness of my inner workings, as scary as that can be sometimes. and I think in general, unless we're just really hardcore introverts or not people, most of us like that sort of thing. I also think there is an element of, how do we create the circumstances where we can be known?
Yeah.
And that is where the kind of that willingness to lean in is really, really important. Yeah. I think it was maybe you and I, Pastor Heather, that were talking about this briefly the other day, how there are our folks at Bridgeway who have been at the church for maybe a year or less. And it's like they've been here forever because they leaned in.
Yeah.
They were proactive about having conversations. And I feel like I know them very well.
Yeah.
Whereas there are others who have maybe been around a long time who possibly I've never even met. And no shade on them. Like, people got to make their choices. But kind of my point is you go, okay, people that have opted in, and we see this in our different ministries that we are part of, that sign up for the class, that sign up to serve, that hang around after the service and look for conversations.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, there's an element of kind of all different sides need to play a part here. Like, yes, we want to be curious about others, but also, am I putting myself in position where people can even be curious about me?
Yeah, I refer to it as the problem of proximity and access. Hmm. So when I'm training up leaders, one of the things that I will talk about is you need to be accessible to the people that you're leading.
Yeah.
You can't just have a wall up of I deliver the content and I run away.
Yeah.
But proximity is crucial to access. You can't have access without proximity at some level.
Yeah.
That there is something supernatural about speaking with somebody face to face versus speaking to somebody over phone, text message, or email.
Yeah.
All the same information can be can be translated that way, because it's not an information thing. There's something about the way that God has designed us that interpersonal communication and interaction has a supernatural effect and really does form us spiritually. And so in order to be known, we need to be present.
Yeah. Yeah.
In order to know others, we need to be present.
Yeah.
And so that presence is crucial to that depth.
Yeah. And that speaks to kind of a point I was trying to make earlier, which is kind of go, okay, we have to sort of lean into the discomfort of that.
Yeah.
It is easy. And again, just using church as an example, but you could use this in other places. It is easy. All right, amen, service is over, and I'm gone.
Yeah.
And I'll admit, like, I can introvert hard in some different environments. There have been plenty of things I've been to where that has been my approach. And surprise, I don't really build community in those spaces, right?
Yeah.
But that willingness to go, no, all right, I'm going to lean in to the vulnerability and potential awkwardness of human interaction.
Yeah.
It's really important.
I think, too, a really practical shift is to think, to be known, I actually have to move beyond information and facts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Into thoughts, opinions, and even feelings.
Yeah.
That takes it even to the next level. That there really are stages of communication and levels of vulnerability.
Yeah.
And it's helpful for us. I mean, we teach this in our START class. It's helpful for us to think, okay, why do I not feel known? Well, actually, maybe I'm not sharing the right information.
Yeah.
That helps me feel known. I have to move beyond information and facts,
yeah,
to thoughts, opinions, and feelings, or I'm going to continue to feel stagnant in my relationships.
Yeah, and that's going to be different for every person, too.
Totally.
Some folks, so if you look at a Myers-Briggs, if you're into that, there's the emotionally driven versus the intellectually driven, you know, and so most people connect with their thoughts and their thinking, and like that's really where they find their pieces, where the feeling side is like, yeah, you can tell me all the information you want, but I don't connect until we can share a feeling.
Yeah.
And like this conversation feels meaningless unless I know where your joy is or where your pain is, you know? And so it's trying to figure out, how do we manage both? You know, my wife is a great host. She loves having people in our home. She's a terrible inviter. And because... And she'll be the first to tell you there is a lot of anxiety and fear of like, what if I'm rejected for the invitation?
Yeah.
And so for us, and then for me, I'm a terrible host, but I'm a great inviter. I'll invite people over and have zero plan on how to, what we're doing.
Well, sounds like you guys make a good team.
Yeah. Imagine that. But one of the things that is great about it, or challenging, is that we both have to take a risk.
Yeah.
And we have to be able to say, this is a risk worth taking. And my encouragement to everybody listening and everybody that I will ever talk to, community is always worth the risk. And I've been through incredibly painful experiences with community.
Yeah.
And it's still worth the risk.
Yeah.
It just is. Isolation is not an answer. And trying to do this on your own and just white knuckling through life is no way to live.
Nope.
And so just honestly, be known and try to know others. Then the third stage is experience. This is where transformation can really happen. This is like through serving together, worshiping together, suffering together, and celebrating together. What shared church moments kind of stand out to you as being formational?
I think some about Love Roseville.
Mm.
And just how that is such a fun event that we do. And, you know, kind of I've bonded with the people that I've served with, even the ones that I've met that day. You know, like I ran into a gal in the lobby and we served together at the art. I can't even remember the art place that we went to.
So briefly, what is Love Roseville?
Oh, sorry. Yes, that'd be helpful. Love Roseville is our once a year kind of community-wide serve event. And we split off into teams and we're assigned different places throughout the community. And we do really practical stuff.
Yeah.
Like we power washed and painted and cleaned out some closets and, you know, a bunch of different things, plant gardens. But there was something about doing that together and making a difference.
Yeah.
It was that we made a difference as a team of 12 that I never could have done on my own, or even just with my husband or my family.
Sure.
Like we really made a difference at that art place that we volunteered at.
Yeah. Certainly have had experiences like that in the past. And it is amazing. Like those experiences really do bond you. I mean, I think about different ministry projects that even, I with either of you, and occasionally some things all three of us together that we've worked through. Or I think about really difficult moments that we've tried to kind of have to lead through and navigate through. Yeah. Those are the types of moments you don't wish for or hope for, but you look back and, well, I don't know. Sometimes you're like, I'm not sure that was worth it, but boy, we sure did bond through it. I think about the bonding that occurs through walking through suffering. I think about just different instances I've had in my own life and in my personal life of whether it's I'm the one who's really suffering and reaching out to somebody else or vice versa, that you lament the suffering. And yet, like in God's weird way of doing things, there is a level of bonding that occurs as you process that suffering together and you support one another through it. Where once again, you go, I don't want the suffering. I want the suffering to go away. And yet, man, there's a level of bonding that takes place. So I think, and these are just the kind of things that, again, can only happen when you put yourself in position to have these shared experiences. And I think, Josh, to what you were talking about earlier, to have that kind of like shared sort of semi-meaningless, quote unquote, time that creates the relational safety for those more in-depth experiences.
One of the things that I've noticed a little bit about Bridgeway, but also just about friends and family and all that kind of together is there's a hesitancy to celebrate together when it's about something I've done or something that somebody else has done, where it's like, I get my master's degree and my wife's like, do you want to do a party? I'm like, if you want to plan something great, but it feels weird for me to say, come celebrate me. Yeah. But there's a missed opportunity in that.
Yeah.
That we are actually robbing each other of this great community connection because we're not celebrating together something that's very basic.
It's so true. And I would have that exact same response if it were me. And yet, and I'm imagining you two would feel the same. If I heard, hey, if you even, not even your wife, Josh, if you told me, hey, I got my master's degree and we're having a party, I'd be like, heck yeah,
great,
I'm in.
Yeah.
Like, let's celebrate you. We should totally celebrate that.
100%.
And yet, again, I'd be in the same boat if I were you. I'm like, oh, this feels very like, I don't know, self-aggrandizing and weird. And it can get that way. Don't get me wrong. But I think you're right. These big life accomplishments. Like, like people want to celebrate with us.
I don't know. I think we need to get better at just articulating our needs and our wins. I mean, about 10 years ago, I kind of stopped expecting other people to throw me parties. And if I want a party, it's okay for me to say, I want a party.
Totally.
If nobody can throw it for me, then I can deal with my fear of rejection. But if I don't articulate the need, then that's an unrealistic expectation of my friends and my husband.
Yeah.
Are they supposed to guess what I want to do and what I don't want to do?
Not guessing. They should know. just
but
kidding.
That's really vulnerable.
Yeah, 100%.
I was just in a conversation with a friend and I was saying, what do you want for your birthday? And, she was kind of hemming and hawing about whether she wanted a party or not. And that's a legitimate struggle sometimes because we've got to take life into account. But I was kind of encouraging her to figure out what she wanted and articulate her need, even though that was really vulnerable. Saying it to myself as well, that we can get better at articulating our need and then dealing with our heartache if it doesn't turn out the way we want it to.
I was encouraged when I was an intern to never turn down a blessing from someone.
Yes.
And so what I mean is that if somebody offers to give you something, your first response should be figuring out, can I actually use this? And like, would this be beneficial so that you don't need to take everybody's puppy? Like that's not, it's like, thank you, but no thanks. I do not need an obligation.
You said blessing, not obligation.
But when we reject somebody's offering to us, what we're doing is we're robbing them of the opportunity to bless somebody else.
Yeah.
And that has always stuck with me. And it's the same thing with celebration, that when we say we don't need something or we don't want something, we're actually robbing the other person of the opportunity to be a blessing and to be celebrating alongside us.
Yeah.
And I think that's huge.
Yeah.
So just to kind of wrap up, the final stage is to go. And this is the Matthew 28, Great Commission that we see, that community is not a destination. It's a launching point for a lot of things. So how does shared experience prepare us for mission?
In so many ways, I think that the joy and the richness and the maturity and the sense of shared purpose that comes from community really sets us up to engage missionally together, whatever that might look like,
right?
Whether that's serving in a church event, whether that's serving in our community, whether that's just getting together and doing something collectively that might not have an obvious service component to it, but it's just us going out and trying something together. I think that is like the bedrock, like you said, that kind of can create that launch point.
Yeah. I mean, it seems, again, kind of trite, but many hands make light work. I mean, there is just, it's more fun to serve with others and to bring others along with you. And we have more to offer.
Yeah.
I mean, what I'm able to offer by myself is so much less than what I'm able to offer if there are several of us.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely
And
right.
I'm aware of needs I'm not aware of. Like, I could go through, I live in a pretty nice neighborhood and needs aren't super apparent. But if I have friends, if I have other friends that have needs that are more apparent that they know about, then I can partner with them in meeting that need.
Yeah,
that's really good. Right. Well, as we're kind of signing off here, I just want to ask the listeners and you guys to just kind of think through this of what is one shared rhythm that you can reintroduce into your life, whether that's a weekly meal, whether that's a consistent church attendance, which is a shared experience every weekend, whether that's serving on a team. But I really would love to encourage the thought of how can you position your life to allow space for community group? This is our ultimate goal as a church, is to see everyone find their community through community groups. And we realize that there's 150 barriers, and we do all sorts of different things to break down those barriers. We've got our start class that helps launch new groups. We've got classes themselves that you can meet other people and connect that way. We do a lot of events as a church so that you can meet others. It's not just so you can attend, have a meal, and go home. It's so that you can interact with other people. These are all ways of kind of getting in there. But honestly, if you can rearrange your life to prioritize community group at some level, I think you will see a dramatic change in the way that you engage with the Lord, the way that you engage with others, and even your satisfaction within your family.
Yeah.
It drastically changes.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. That's something all three of us have experienced in our own community groups and so many others at Bridgeway. And Pastor Heather and myself are here to help you in that process. So reach out to us if we can be of any help to you at all. For our next segment, we are finally playing an interview I did almost a month ago with Christian Downs, National Training Director for Alpha USA. We lost an episode a few weeks ago that he was originally supposed to be on, but he was terrific, great guy for a Seahawks fan. And hope you enjoy what he has to say. And we'll be back to wrap up the episode right after we're done with him. So we'll be right back. We are back, and for this next segment, I'm excited to be joined by Christian Downs. He is the National Training Director from Alpha USA. He is here in town leading our evangelism workshop that we just had here at Bridgeway and was kind enough to sit down with me for a conversation. Christian, thanks so much for taking some time.
Oh, so glad to be here. What a fun night to kick it off, and now we get to sit down and have a conversation after.
Yes, we do. It's been a great event. By the time this episode airs, it'll have been, I think, 2 weeks in the past, but it was a great night tonight, and I'm looking forward to more good stuff tomorrow. Now, I'm a big fan of Alpha. We've been running Alpha programs here for a while. I got to lead a group myself a while back, which was a lot of fun. But The sense I've gotten is the struggle we have here at Bridgeway is not all that uncommon in that it can be tough to get everybody to really understand sort of what alpha is. So for any of our listeners who are new to alpha or don't know exactly what alpha is, can you explain a little bit of what alpha is all about? What's the mission? What are you trying to accomplish?
Yeah, Alpha, if you think about it, it's more than a course. Alpha really is a space between community and church where folks that do go to church can invite their non-Christian or doubtful or wrestling with faith friends into a conversation that starts with some time of connection, right? Around a meal, around some sort of shared experience that is really just authentic and fun. And then we unpack one of the 10 most commonly asked questions that people outside the church want to discuss if they were to have faith conversations. And so Alpha was really built around those 10 most commonly asked questions. And then there is a short video that unpacks that in an informative, non-preachy, just teaching type of way, really to provoke thought and spark discussion. So we watch a video, and then the sweet spot of Alpha is that small group discussion time right afterwards where the guests get to say what they believe. We like to say the video is where we as Christians say what we believe, and the discussion time is when the guests get to say what they believe. So you get together for a time of connection, you watch some engaging content, and it's not like another cheesy church video that we've all seen probably too many of.
Mm-hmm.
Our producers were actually on the X-Men video series as well. So it's quality stuff. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. So
the production quality of the Alpha videos is fantastic. And even we've used the youth videos here, which that takes it to a whole different level. Something I enjoyed about the Alpha experience was that discussion time. And what I found interesting was the guests that we had in my case, they were all either new believers or were like right kind of on the cusp. It seemed just really refreshing for people to feel like they had a safe space to just talk openly about spiritual things. And I think a lot of us, we tend to think, especially as Christians, maybe that like non-believers aren't looking for that, when in fact they are, right?
Yeah, that's so completely true. There's a recent survey that came out that says 72% of U.S. adults, which equates, by the way, to 188 million people 18 years of age and older in our country alone, are open to exploring faith topics and having conversation about them. So actually more people than we maybe would give credit to are actually willing to have this type of conversation. And if it's not with us, they're going to other places.
Right.
There's another one that just came out that says, is God real or something similar is being Googled 200 times per second around the world.
That's wild.
It equates to 17 and a half million times a day.
Wow.
So
that's crazy.
There are people that are asking questions. A lot of people are asking questions because the ways of the world have returned void.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Now, when it comes to sharing our faith, inviting folks to church, inviting people to a place like Alpha, there is a fatal flaw of invitation that I just heard you talk about tonight that I thought was pretty interesting. What is that fatal flaw?
Yeah, what I call the fatal flaw of invitation is really when we say no to God on behalf of someone else before we even make the ask, before we make the invitation and allow the Holy Spirit to work. We're stifling the work of the Spirit. We're not partnering in the work of the Spirit. And we're called to go and to invite, not to convert. So who are we to get in the way?
Yeah, absolutely. It's so funny listening to you talk about that. I've thought about how just in my own life in general, I've tried to like develop the discipline of not saying no for people. If I want someone to do something, if I want to invite someone to something, don't assume they're going to say, like, let them say no, right?
Right.
And I think when it comes to faith conversations especially, which feel a little more vulnerable, we tend to just kind of automatically say no. And like you said, that's quite the fatal flaw. What are some other things that stop people from engaging in spiritual conversations, making invitations to church, stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, the other ones that really get in the way, you know, when we ask this question in groups, fear always comes up first and foremost. The notion that you might not know answers to their questions, the thought that you might not be mature enough in your own belief. I literally just spoke with someone tonight that said, well, I've only been a Christian for a year and it might feel hypocritical if I go back to some people that knew me, you know, before a year ago. I don't know that I'm ready to do that. And I just said, well, when would we be ready?
Yeah.
Is it 3 years? Is it 5 years? Because I'm at 14 years and I still sometimes have those feelings,
sure.
Especially when we let the enemy get a little bit of a foothold and say, this isn't you, that you're not ready. You're not right.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And it's funny how much we can just get in our own heads
oh my goodness,
about,
so much.
About stuff like that. Oh, What are some ways that you're seeing people start faith conversations, or what are some kind of strategies we can use to get involved in faith conversations that don't feel forced or awkward or cliche or kind of any of those things?
Yeah, I think it's really just starts with an understanding that we need to earn the right to have some of those. And there's some almost like relational pathways that I like to unpack that comes from a friend, Doug Schaup, who wrote the book I Once Was Lost, co-authored with Don Everettson. And Doug is a vice president for InterVarsity. And in this book, they unpack the thresholds that people go through. Okay. And the first one is people that are outside the church, first they just need to trust a Christian. So I always challenge people that I know inside the church, who knows you that doesn't believe, that actually trusts you?
Yeah.
Like, we need to go from a place of distrust to trust. And a lot of times that happens from having fun, laughing, having a meal together. And from trust, you can spark opportunities to help them become curious by the way that you respond differently than they maybe would because of Jesus in your life,
yeah.
right? And then from curiosity, you start to see a potential avenue of openness when the conversation almost becomes a two-way street.
Yeah.
And now they're like, man, I wonder if that would be the same for me if I had the same experiences as you. And so it really starts relationally.
Yeah.
Like, what does it look like there? And the second kind of avenue that I would go down is sometimes it just helps us to know what people are most likely to say yes to an invitation, or who are most likely the most open to at least engaging in a faith or a church type conversation.
Yeah.
And I like to use kind of the framework or the list of people that are recently or currently going through some sort of critical life moment.
Yeah.
Oftentimes are the most receptive because there's so many other things in flux in their life that they're like, gosh, I don't know where to turn to.
Yeah.
So I think of things like a geographical change, a family situational change, a financial shift, layers of grief, obviously timing extremely important, and then lastly, personal life challenges.
Yeah.
And if you know some folks that are going through something like that, there might just be an opportunity for you to share the hope that you have in Jesus and in your faith that could lead to quite a fruitful faith or invitation conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to go back to what you said about trust and that sense of who is there that doesn't know Christ who trusts you. There, of course, is all sorts of research out there talking about the idea that, like, the longer you're a Christian, the less likely you are to have actual non-Christian friends because
yes.
we get involved in church culture, things like that. What advice would you give to believers who are going, man, I want to get into environments where I can actually make friends with people who don't know Christ? Like, what are some things we can do?
I would say the first bit is a challenge to just be known in non-churchy places. So yeah. I like to put out that challenge where are you known in two non-Christian places? And it could be the gym, it could be some sort of social group, it could be a neighborhood HOA committee that you serve on, whatever it may be, but something to the point that if you missed more than one or a couple sessions or a couple meetings or whatever it may be, that they would actually notice that you're gone, right?
Yeah.
A few people there know your name. And there you have an opportunity to have some experiences with people. And as we mentioned earlier, trust really comes from some of those shared experiences. It's even amplified with a meal and with laughing. So
yeah.
have a fun meal.
Yeah,
right?
There you go.
Let's go. Who doesn't want to do something like that?
Totally.
And yeah, so get known, build some trust by just getting out there. Outside of some of these churchy spaces.
And something else you talked about tonight was the idea of judgment-free listening. Talk to us about what that is.
It's almost like Christians should leave conversations with their unchurched friends with a bloodied tongue, right? Like, we have to be comfortable biting our tongue and not feeling the need to step in and like judge or correct and
yeah.
try to prove someone wrong. It's almost like pointing a finger in someone's face, and what that's, you might as well just be giving them a verbal punch that says stay away.
Yeah.
Where actually what we want to be able to do is absorb some of that hostility, even take, as I would go so far as to say, take the awkward bullet of some of those conversational moments
yeah.
and not be shaken or shocked by what our unchurched friends say.
Yeah.
And to be able to lean in and say, oh, wow. And then maybe you could rephrase or say something a little different, but you know, you're building trust in those environments and you're making it known that, wow, we can be real and we can be relational. While internally we're relying on the Holy Spirit to help.
Yeah. It's funny. I have a teenage son and a preteen son. And of course, you know, conflict in the house between the two of them.
Oh,
and
never,
everything else.
Never.
Yeah, I know. I just imagine, if you will, that happens. But, you know, something I am trying to help them with is not sort of constantly correcting each other or others on very minor things.
Right.
And I tell them, guys, people do not like to be corrected. So if you're correcting someone, make sure like it really matters. Like someone's about to get hurt. Something is really serious. And I think, I don't know where this comes from. Maybe you have some insight into this, that we have this impulse that we need to correct everything that is not honoring to the Lord or ungodly or whatever that we encounter out in the world. And we can't just like have normal conversations with people without the need to get into this sort of corrective mode. Is that something you see? Or like, where does that come from? And what do we do with it?
Yeah, I think a lot of times Christians enter those opportunities with the best of intentions, thinking that this is a way that they could plant a seed or that they could share the gospel, when really it's turning people away because it feels like a system of rules rather than a relationship rooted in love.
Right.
And a lot of times we can show love and then we can demonstrate our faith by acting differently in those same situations.
Yeah.
But I don't know many people that have been corrected or argued into the faith that stayed with the faith.
Right.
You know, I love kind of the statement that says, if someone can be argued into the faith, then they can also be argued out of it.
That's good.
So that's we need to create those spaces where people feel like they can actually be heard.
Yeah.
Because we know that being heard and being loved are received in such a similar way that for the average person, they are almost indistinguishable.
That's right. David Augsburger, one of my seminary professors.
Oh, so good. That's right.
Love that quote. Now, we had some time tonight at the session where we were praying, and I really enjoyed that time. Just was praying for some different people in my life, and one of the sessions of prayer was led with kind of this prompt that we're not just praying for salvation; we're praying for people. Can you help me understand that nuance a little bit?
Yeah, I think the main difference there is when we're praying for salvation, we're praying for almost like an outcome that we're a part of.
Hmm.
We're almost playing a little bit of that role of God, maybe ourselves. But yet when we're praying for people, we're lifting up their whole self, the whole experience. And we might not be involved in their faith journey whatsoever. But when we pray for a whole person, to me, that includes praying for their family, their job situation, whatever it may be, their comings and their goings. And hopefully as a result, there's opportunities for, you know, other Christians and faith expressions to enter into their life.
Yeah. I've been in so many environments where it's like, yeah, okay, pray for your non-Christian friends, family, whatever, which is great. Like, obviously we should do that. But so often it has been kind of salvation centric, which like, obviously we want them to be saved. But that idea of going, okay, let's just be praying about everything. Like, it was almost weird to me tonight to go, I don't know that I've been in like an evangelism training like this, where it's been like, hey, pray for them about everything, which seems so obvious.
Yeah. I think when we pray for the whole person, there might be an opportunity that we get invited into more types of conversation, right? There might just be an open door. I know my wife always tells me, Christian, when I hear you pray, I hear more of your heart and I actually can hear that you were listening because, you know, Christian, you never listen. Well, I hear every time she says I don't listen, so I don't know. But I know that when we're praying for the whole person, there might be more opportunities for us to engage in their whole life.
Yeah.
And that's a fun thing to think of as well.
I want to just spend a few minutes talking a little bit about your story here. I got to hear some of it tonight, but you came to Christ through somebody reaching out to you and through kind of evangelistic influence of others. Can you tell us about whose influence led you to eventually surrender your life to Christ?
Yeah, I did grow up in a Christian household, and I didn't just walk. I literally ran 180 degrees the opposite direction, basically right out of high school. And after loads of unhealthy friends, bad decisions, it ended up down a road of 8 years of heroin addiction.
Wow.
And it was after my failed rehab attempt, losing my job that did an intervention and actually paid for me to go to a 30-day treatment program. And they paid me like I was on vacation while I was there. So super generous and thoughtful of them. But it was when I entered a faith-based recovery program because after I lost my job, I had to move back into my mom's house, which no 26-year-old ever wants to do, let me tell you.
Yeah.
But she did call me out and said, if I think you're using it all, you won't be able to stay here. I had much younger siblings that were in the house still, and she did not want that negative influence. And I basically, out of my actions, called her bluff, and I came home one day, and the locks were changed, and she would not answer. But what broke my heart is I could hear her crying on the inside, on the inside of the house as she held strong. And I ended up noticing that she had left a New Testament with a note inside on the front porch on top of a little duffel bag of some of my things that she put together. And the note said, other people have tried to help you. It's time for you to help yourself, but you know who to turn to.
Wow.
And it had a phone number to a faith-based recovery program that I ended up going to reluctantly. And on my third day, there was an alpha presentation done by a church that drove from about 20 minutes away. And I remember thinking, hey, this sounds great. It gets me out of rehab one night a week, and it includes better food than I'm sure we're getting here. So I said yes. Didn't even know what alpha was. Wow. Didn't really care. And when I went, I was blown away that these people wanted nothing from me except for to engage in life with me. They wanted to hear from me. They wanted to welcome me and to go on a journey with me. And after coming back to faith on that Alpha weekend, really experiencing the goodness of God through the power and presence of the Holy Spirit, which was news to me. The church that I grew up in, the Trinity was more Father, Son, Holy Bible, with maybe recited prayers. Not that feeling, not that relationship, not that experience of God in such a powerful and good way.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, you live in Seattle. The yellow thing you saw in the sky this
morning.
Sun. That was the sun.
I've heard about it.
No, it's pretty
nice. I didn't know it's available in January.
Occasionally it is. But sorry, that was such a low-hanging fruit Seattle joke.
That's all right.
But
I
you've probably
it.
Heard it a Used thousand it. Times. Yeah. So yeah. There you go. Seattle, not known for its spiritual fervor. What have you found most challenging about doing evangelism in a place like Seattle?
Yeah, I mean, the relational component is still first and foremost, it is key. And even though it feels like it's, I would say up and down the West Coast, right? We're known as kind of the dark spiritual coast from Seattle to Portland to San Francisco to LA.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of other things to do. And church isn't usually high on someone's list. We're quite far from the Bible Belt. However, we did a recent thing in Seattle that I would venture to guess is the same here. We went out and just blindly asked 100 people if we could pray for them on an evangelism team with a whole bunch of organizations and churches that I'm a part of in Seattle. And 99 out of 100 people said yes.
Wow.
The only person that said no, he was in a hurry to a church thing. Can you believe it? And so that's literally funny. Basically 100% of the people said yes, that they would accept prayer. And now it seems like more and more, not only the felt need of like outreach efforts from the church, but the receptiveness of the community at large is heightened in such a way that churches are working together. They're setting aside denominations, parts of the church, Catholic and Protestant working together. They're putting aside any other differences and saying we need to reach and pray for and lean into the lostness of our city.
Yeah.
And as a result, we're seeing heightened numbers in prayer gatherings, in alpha courses, alpha churches, and guest participants across the board, nationally and globally, by the way.
Can you give me a sense, that 100 people prayer thing, what were some of those interactions like? I'm so curious to know. You're just talking to random people, presumably many of whom are far from God, but they're saying yes to the invitation to prayer. What was going on there?
Yeah, I was blown away. I thought I was going to get a lot of dirty looks, a few colorful words, maybe someone kick me in the shins as they go by. And people were like, you know what? You can pray. Some of them real quick. You can pray for my family. You can pray for my child. You can pray for my job. And sometimes it might just be, hey, you can, like, my finances are hard, you know, kind of surface level. But what really blew me away is when people realize, wow, this is approachable. Some people actually followed up and said, actually, would you pray for this as well?
Wow.
And they would all of a sudden go from that surface level to a layer deeper. And now I feel like we're not only earning trust, we're almost building curiosity and getting to that openness in a matter of a few moments.
Yeah.
There is power in prayer. So it was a great way to lean in.
That's amazing. It was interesting also just now hearing you talk about Seattle and just the sense of partnership among churches and Christians there. I was just in Portland actually for an Alpha event, one of the city showcases.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Portland, not known again for its spiritual fervor, but so amazing to see. There are so many incredible churches up there. Amazing Christian ministries are based up there. And I sensed there a real sense of partnership. So we're in this like little mini Bible Belt of the West Coast, like here in Placer County, there's huge churches all over the place. It's kind of this anomaly in California. But I'm so encouraged, and I imagine you must be as well, to see that level of partnership in these places that are less churched. To me, that just, I don't know, that feels like evidence of God really moving in these places.
I 100% agree. And there's such power in that unity where people do put aside maybe their church logo or ideas, and they're not saying, well, what if this guest that I invite doesn't come to our church because we're partnering with all the others? It's about the kingdom, not about, you know, our filling our pews and seats in a sanctuary. So Seattle saw in this last fall at the end of 2025, 44 churches partnered together for a unified alpha launch.
Wow. Portland
saw a similar, maybe even a few more. And San Francisco, just down the road, saw over 60 partner together.
No kidding.
And run alpha together in the fall. And then they did a unified day away, which is where we really unpack the third part of the Trinity and the Holy Spirit and have a time to pray for and with guests in a different way.
Amazing. That's incredible. So as we wrap up, just kind of turning our attention back to kind of that personal evangelism side of things, we've talked about finding places where you're known. We've talked about building trust. We've talked about kind of being approachable. What other advice do you have for those who, especially maybe those who are not natural extroverts or a little more shy or nervous about sharing their faith? What other advice can you give us for just having more natural, spiritual, and evangelistic conversations?
I would say the power of your story is amazing.
Yeah.
It's about the one thing that people can't really argue with. It's really hard for me to tell you that, oh, you didn't do that. I'm like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
I completely did that. So leaning into your own story and to be able to share it in a short and concise, compelling way that might open the door to other, you know, conversations. So knowing your story and then knowing how to very clearly say the difference that Jesus has made in your own life is definitely one that is important. Like Jesus didn't take away my sarcasm. He just cleaned it up a bit.
Amen.
Right. And when you really lean in and think of it in that way, there is just an opportunity to pray for boldness, to pray for courage. And I would say my biggest encouragement is to go try it. The worst that's going to happen is you're going to hear the word no.
Yep.
And it's okay. Yep. And a lot of times no are actually not yet. I've had multiple people come back even a year, two, 3 years later and say, hey, do you still do that alpha thing? Because this is happening and I think it might be the right time.
Yeah, that's wild. You just never know.
Never know.
You never know. Christian Downs, once again, huge fan of alpha. Thank you for the incredible work you do. Thanks for coming here to Bridgeway. And most of all, just thanks for taking this time to talk with me. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be right back. All right. Well, thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoyed what Christian had to say. Thank you to our guest host, Pastor Heather, for being with us on this episode. Thanks to Devin Strootman for editing, making us sound good. Thanks to all of you for listening. If you like what you heard, leave us a rating or review on iTunes or Spotify, and we will be back in 2 weeks.